Hey, Adam.
Hey, Dee.
I've got a question for you.
What is it?
What's your relationship with work?
I don't know, but I guess I'm going to send it a Dear John letter.
You are. I'm excited about this question because what are we talking about today?
We are talking about CXetera, where we discuss the future of customer experience and a bit more. As you were teeing up for me, and I had to just like jump in the middle of what we were talking about today is.
I know. I'm so glad you do, and I'm so glad you always structure me in our intros because I'm always just like, "What's up? Let's get into the topic," and you're like, "Excuse me, this is a show."
I have editor brain. That's the issue. Like, I'm thinking about the limited amount of editing that I have to do on this show. And I'm like, if we don't say the title of the show, then I don't know where to put the music.
I'm a chaotic neutral, I guess, or like chaotic good. It's just very, yeah.
Have you heard this thing? Like, I know you're doing D&D alignments, but like, have you heard about the thing that like every relationship has a chaos Muppet and an order Muppet?
I did read something about this recently. What was it again?
Honestly, I don't know. I don't know what the source material for this is. It's just something my friends always talk about. And, you know, you can identify in any relationship, basically, like who's the chaotic person and who's the lawful person, you know?
Maybe it was a little bit different because I've been using the term chaos monkey a lot. It's like where, for example, I'll be like in the middle of doing something in the kitchen and then I'll get distracted and I'll leave. Like I'll leave a cup or I'll leave like a dish or something like that that's like dirty, yeah. But it's in progress. And then Ryan will sweep through and be like, oh, this is dirty. Let me put it in the sink. And then I'll come back and I'll be like, where's my entire setup? And then I'll be like, oh, I found this dirty dish or whatever. And I put it in the sink and I'm like, you chaos monkey. Like what? He's like, what? It's dirty. I put it in the sink. And I'm like, right. It, you know, like that's extremely logical, except
yeah.
To me, it's absolute chaos.
Ryan, we're not going to invent penicillin if you keep doing that.
I know, it's just not going to happen. So yes, that's
right. But why don't we talk about our relationship to work?
Yes, let's do it. Okay, so let's talk about how this, like why we're talking about this book and why it came about very briefly.
And what is it? Because we're holding this up on the video, but I think most people are listening to the show. What book are we holding up?
So we're holding up On Work, which is authored by Derek Thompson, who is he's been a writer for The Atlantic since like the early aughts or late aughts or the aughts, let's just say. And he also recently came out with a book that's like very, very popular at the moment or very much in the news right now that he co-authored with Ezra Klein called Abundance. It's a bit related to this, but it's a bit more on the political side of things. So this book is something that I read a couple of years ago. It was recommended to me when I was sort of starting at Miro. I was in between, you know, like I was transitioning from a job at Visa, moving into Miro, and I was really just having some conversations around going back into the hyper-growth startup world because I had been in there before and kind of dipped in and dipped out. And so I was sort of like readying myself for that. Again, anyway, so I found it to be an incredibly interesting book. And so when you and I were talking about our relationships with work recently, I was like, why don't we do kind of a book club thing? It's a short book, like that is just jam packed with really interesting stuff.
Yeah, it's dense.
Yeah,
it's like dense. It's a rich text for being what is it? It's like 84 pages.
Yeah, yeah. Super short. Yeah, you nailed it. It's 84 pages and very dense. And so and this is something that we talk about a lot in our like phone calls a lot. We're like, hey, you know, how are we feeling as leaders? How are we feeling as employees, as people? You know, what's the balance like? What are the things we want to do in life, et cetera? And I think one of the things that we share as friends is this kind of common desire, correct me if I'm wrong, to be like fairly well-balanced, well-rounded people. You know, we want to be good at various things. We want to have sort of all of the things in our life going at once. We don't want to like overly sacrifice, like, but while understanding also that there will be some seasonality in things and we might, you know, be a little bit imbalanced from time to time and that's okay. That's part of the process. And so,
yeah. And I think maybe we hit that balance differently in our own ways, but I think what we have in common and what makes us talk about this a lot is that we are both people who have, I mean, I say this like out of thankfulness, not out of like trying to flex. Like, I think we've been pretty successful in our careers, and we have we've invested a lot in getting to where we are and doing the work that we do. But I think in that we've also like, we don't want our work to be our identity.
Yeah.
And I think that's the tension that we often face, that I certainly often face, because I recognize that, you know, kind of to do the types of things that we do and to get to the places that we are, like it's impossible to do that without leaving at least a little bit of yourself on the table. And so the question is like, how do we do that? And how do we drive the types of results, build the types of teams and programs that we do without it completely consuming our identities? And that's what I also thought was at the core of this book. So I'm really glad you recommended it to me.
Okay, good. I'm glad you liked it. Yeah. And I think it's going to be interesting because, you know, you read it really recently. I read it a while ago. I was trying to reread it and then things happened and I didn't reading, but I have my copy. It's got a lot of highlights in it. I actually found like some, an iNote that I had where I jotted down a couple things. So I feel reasonably prepared, even though I'm a little further out from having read it. But yeah, shall we just dive in into like what the premise of it was?
Yeah. Yeah. Why don't you mansplain this book to me?
I will. Okay. So the general concept, or like one of the big ideas that he has in this book, Derek Thompson, is that because of the decline of organized religion and people having a space to kind of, you know, build community and worship, which there's an interesting point that I kind of grapple with that he makes in the book, that like people need to worship stuff anyway. Mm-hmm. But because of the decline of that, what is replacing it is this thing called workism, where essentially people are making work their religion. And this I thought was so visceral. He said the desk becomes an altar. And I was like, oh, damn, boy. Like, what is it? But that's his central thesis here, is that that's what's happening and it's not a good thing.
I wrote down his definition of workism. Because I really liked it. It's the belief that work is not only necessary to economic production, but also the centerpiece of one's identity and life's purpose.
Ooh, brutal.
It really, it stuck with me. And I agree. I was equally struck by the idea that work for a lot of people, like if we kind of take the idea of workism and religion, that it has replaced community that people would have gotten in the past from going to church or doing activities together, or I don't know, other ways we would have gotten community. Not to cite your coach and mentor Brad Stolberg every time, but like when he talks about groundedness, like the idea of like building community being so essential to remaining grounded, like the fact that we used to do this through things that were outside of work, and now we've kind of conflated that with work and with the office. And for a lot of people, that's the only source of community that they're actually getting. Like that actually becomes wildly imbalanced in a lot of ways, right? Because work and purpose have like really leaked into each other in a way that they wouldn't if you were like a farmer in the 1500s.
Yeah.
Like, that's kind of how he starts, right?
Yeah. Yeah. And then I think like he's also talking about, cause this is like post or in the middle of the pandemic that he wrote this, or something in that general.
I think it's a collection of essays, right? So like some are like pre-pandemic and some are during and some are after.
Yeah. And he's got like a big foreword or whatever, where he's talking about most of this. But I think that also had its role to play, right? People started to work pretty much exclusively remotely. And so he talks a lot about that. He talks about AI, which is a bit dated in here, but I think that's an interesting thing to think about too, and what that is doing to job. And I think that there's also a lot of data, and I can't remember if this is in the book or like in some of the interviews and stuff that I'd seen, like he actually did a talk with Democratic ticket UBI.
Andrew Yang.
Yes. Yes. And so they have a chat where they basically talk about how, and I thought at the time this was so fascinating, where it's like, why is work the only way that you can get currency, make money? Like there are other ways to do it. There should be other ways to do it at this point, especially with AI if that's legitimately a thing they were arguing at the time that we believe is going to change the world, which it is, then shouldn't we be ahead of the game figuring out how people are going to actually make money outside of work?
Yeah. And I mean, like, I certainly don't agree with everything that Yang had to say, but like, I think the point that this is a trend that's coming and we need to think ahead of it, and like something like UBI at some point is going to become necessary if our jobs get automated away. Like I do agree with that point. Just remembering the structure of the book, he kind of starts with this idea of workism and how it's basically replaced religion and community for a lot of us. And then he traces the two major shifts that were happening at the time. And you called them out, but I think we can kind of, maybe we can do one and the other if we want. The first was automation and AI. And that's where he was getting into the whole discussion of UBI. And he has this whole long case study about a town in where is it? Pennsylvania. So I'm not going to flip the book. That basically had, and maybe Michigan, where the entire industry left the city. So they had to completely reinvent their economy to be essentially a post-work economy. And they're bartering and doing things like that. I thought that was really interesting. And then the second trend that he talks about is the shift towards remote work and the pandemic and what is the role of the office kind of in community. So I liked that he was focused on those two areas.
Oh yeah. You mean this Youngstown, Ohio?
Youngstown, yeah. Oh, yeah. Ohio. Yeah. I think I said every Rust Belt state except the one that it was actually in.
Or Ohio.
Yeah. Oh my goodness. Sorry, Junan. Sorry that we forgot Ohio.
Oh my gosh.
Junan is the world's biggest. He's self-professed
Ohio
world's biggest CX Etera fan, but I know he's the world's biggest Ohio fan.
He's pro Ohio.
He's pro. Oh my god. Okay.
So good. How? Like, okay. So just, I want to take it a little bit to a personal level. Like, how did you kind of identify with this book, and how did you sort of contrast or compare it to your relationship with work? Maybe right now, or maybe at some other point in time.
There were a few things that he said in there that really made me think about my own relationship to work. And it is a lot of the things that we talked about. The reason why he's talking about workism in the first place is he's citing some other guy whose name that I don't remember, but he's like, work originally was about the economy being able to produce goods. And then for the people who are the workers, it's about income. But then now there's this third thing that's been grafted on, which is this activity that lends meaning or purpose to us. And that's where the idea of workism comes. And that really made me think, I'm definitely someone who has shaped a lot of my own identity around who I am at work and what I've achieved at work. I do think in some ways I've worshipped at the altar and spent the late nights and fit in some ways into some of the categories he talks about, right? Because he talks about millennials, of which I am one, especially for millennials who are kind of overeducated in a lot of ways and have gone into white collar jobs. We have a little bit of alienation because we don't produce tangible things. And so the way that he talks about it is we need social media as our artifacts, right? Since we can't we can't build the widget and look at the widget and say, oh, that's a nice widget that I just made here. What do we make? What are we proud of? Well, he says we make social media posts. And that's a way that we can kind of take the intangible and make it tangible. And I feel that really hard. I also feel that in terms of one of the reasons why I like being in scaled CX, customer education, this field is that at the very least, we make digital things, right? We make a community, we make courses, we make campaigns. So I do get some satisfaction from that. But for having put so much of my identity into work and achievement and kind of chasing these titles and all of that, it's not really about the money or the economic stability about it. It is about purpose, and it is about to some extent feeding my own ego or my own identity and feeling that sense of achievement. And even as someone who's been kind of a loud LinkedIn person for a long time, I feel like I'm only just now really learning what my relationship to speaking in public is and what it's for and what I actually want to do with it. It feels different than it used to.
I love that. And I know some of those things we've talked about and continue to talk about quite a bit because we're both grappling with it, I think, in different ways. I agree with all. I mean, we're not having an argument, so I can't agree with it. I'm saying, like, I identify with a lot of that as well. And I think also the other thing, which I know you'll understand because we've talked about this too, is there's like this additional layer of like model minority to me about it as an immigrant, right? Where it was like very, there's like a concept of making it that immigrants have that is very different from, like, you know, if you just, I don't know, like maybe if you're not an immigrant. And so I think there's like a pressure there as well that I used to experience a lot earlier in my career. I mean, I still sometimes do, but I think it was like pretty, pretty loud back then, where it was like, this is, you know, like, this is what success looks like, and this is what, you know, like making it looks like, and that sort of a thing, that that kind of wove, like, I guess work became a part of another identity that was really strong for me, which was one of like an immigrant that, you know, like had moved here, and also like elder child and first, you know, in my family to like move to this part of the world. I mean, well, that's not really true, to America, let's say, because my parents moved to the West from the East, so they did that first. So I think all those things were like wrapped up in it. And so that creates other issues of like, it's not just about work, but it's about the anti-work, which is rest. Like, you also have like really weird concepts of rest, and you have weird concepts of like always being online versus offline and all of those types of things. And it amplified, I think, for our generation of immigrants, because we were like, you know, digital natives, but like we had a time that of life that we experienced like a handful of formative years where technology was not about, like, there was no attention economy at the time, like not as like markedly as, you know, like as it is today. And so it wasn't so like there were clear delineations between work and non-work. But I think that there was a component of it that I really miss now, which is like there are family obligations that were a part of at least cultural identity that have been eroded by technology, that I also think was like a part of it for me, where it's like, you know, you did not question when you were growing up that every night at 8 p.m. or whatever it is, like you had dinner at the table with your family and there were no devices. There were like, when I was younger, I was like reading comic books or Archie comics or whatever. It was like, nope, that's got to be off, right? So whatever the thing was at the time, whatever the media vehicle was at the time, no, you put that away and you have a conversation with your family, if you're lucky enough to have a family that you can sit down and have a meal with, right? But that doesn't exist now.
No, because he talks about that leaking. I feel that leaking. And it's exactly it. The fact that like work can kind of show up in your life at any time, and people know, right? People know you're on Slack. People know you're on email. And as someone who worked at Slack, like I feel like that was something that was very present for me, and something that I was thinking about a lot, because I was trying to figure out, okay, I work for this company that I believe in and that I think is like genuinely useful technology, but if you don't take control of it, it takes control of you. So, you know, I was trying to build a great customer education program at Slack while I was also reading Cal Newport books and talking to my coworkers about like, How do I balance having this always on software with like probably that not actually being healthy from the way it leaks one part of my life into the other. But Dee, I have a question for you, like based on the immigrant thing, because like he talks about it in the book when he's talking about millennials. But like one thing I was thinking about is he kind of ties that idea of alienation and not having that sense of like tangible achievement into hustle culture. And I think like for millennials, but also like what I've seen in a lot of immigrant communities, like hustle culture becomes a really big thing, right? Because there's that kind of like status anxiety, there's that there's the work ethic. So I'm curious, like you had those barriers in your life, like when you were a kid and when you were growing up with your family, but like since you started working, like did you still have that at any point, or was like work already leaking in? And also like, do you feel like hustle culture and status anxiety was really playing a role there too?
Not really. So yes and no. So it's so wild. So I think for me what it was, and this is, I was just thinking about this recently, I don't know how much we've even talked about this, But I actually had two jobs for a really long time, like a really long time. And I mean, I had full-time job, and then I was like, well, this is 40 hours a week. Like, I want to do more. I wasn't intellectually feeling stimulated. I didn't feel like I was learning a lot. And ironically, I was in a learning job. And so I ended up getting a job at this like very small startup at part-time that was flexible. I could do it nights and weekends. And so that's what I did. And I was like, but, and that's because I wanted to do it. And I also, you know, it was like, I was very young, right? You're in your 20s, you have all this energy and you have all these things you want to do.
But it's not like the economic driver. It's not like I need to take two jobs because I need the money. It's like I need the job because like that will give me purpose, it sounds like, right?
Yeah. Right. And it, so I think it was, there was like this self-actualization piece, right? Which is what all of this identity stuff is all about, that I feel like, oh my God, I'm going to be behind if I don't, you know, like really like ramp up right now in my 20s. And so I was like doing that. I kind of actually did that through the beginning of my 30s as well. And, you know, and but also remember, like I was coming from a career into tech. So this was like my first few years in tech where I was like doing two tech jobs, but like one academia and one like tech, but I was coming from a place where freelancing was really popular, you know, so you worked for the media and then you also freelance, like you wrote, you did things for other like media entities and that kind of thing. So that was also really common. So that's why I want to like normalize that for a second. It wasn't that unusual to be somebody who was, you had like multiple income streams that early.
No, like I did similar things too. Like I had my full-time job, but I was also always doing like little side gigs here and there, either because they were interesting or like they would kind of round something out.
Exactly. And then when I went into my first job where it became, well, first of all, it was like, it was an amount of money now where I was like, okay, well, they need my full attention. This is different from like the previous roles that, you know, you're like, I can get this stuff done really quickly and they're not asking me to do anything else. You're kind of punching in and punching out, which is why you might get something second to sort of like amp up the challenge. Now you're like, okay, this is all consuming. I got to quit the side stuff and you do all of this, right? So that was kind of like how I had started my 30s. And then that was really when I actually, funnily enough, started to feel the strain of lack of work-life balance. Was not what I had.
Oh, interesting.
Yeah, that's what it is. It's like not when I had multiple jobs and was actually working more hours. It's when I had one job and they felt like they owned me. But this is also, it could be bad management. Like I remember I had this first-time manager and he used to call our team, which our team was like small. It was like four or five people. He used to like group text us, I kid you not, at 11 p.m. on a Friday night being like, hey, you guys want to grab a virtual drink and like come hack like and like build some stuff together online? And we were like, you're talking to the youth in on a Friday night? Like no one's home, boo. Okay, like spoiler alert, I was actually. But it's just wild, right? Like so that was when I started to feel like, okay, when someone feels, you know what it is, and this is actually something I'm attaching to a comment I saw you make on LinkedIn maybe today, early morning or yesterday or something, where you were talking about Slack, but it's all about etiquette. It's all about kind of what you talked about, like have a, you know, like a policy or something for how you use these things before they use you. I think ultimately the lack of balance from me personally stemmed not from the hours I was working or the stuff that I was working on, excuse me, because I get tunnel vision. I like, if I'm loving the work that I'm doing, like I will look up and I'm like, oh, all these hours have passed.
Yeah.
But if I feel like there's no agency of my own time in doing that, then I have an issue.
Yeah. No, D, that's like such a rich text, what you just said. I love it because not only does it resonate with me, but it makes me think of a couple of things, some of which are in the book. God, where do we start? Okay. Let's start with what you just talked about. You talked about the flow state. Right? Like when you get so into the work that it doesn't feel like work.
Deep work.
And deep work, Cal Newport, but also flow.
Exactly.
And do you know who did the research on flow?
Do tell.
This guy named Mikhail Csikszentmihalyi, whose name I can never spell and can barely pronounce.
Yeah.
But I always think of him as the flow guy. And I never looked into what other research he ever did. He shows up in this book. And
remember that
he does. He does. Yeah. And he's doing something around, like his research is around what is called the paradox of work.
Oh, yeah, yeah.
Which I loved in this book, because he's like, you were talking about rest earlier, and in the book, Derek Thompson is talking about leisure, which I think, like, let's kind of call that the same thing, right? Like, just non-work stuff you do purely for yourself. Yeah. The paradox of work that he's talking about is basically, like, we love complaining about work, but people who are working, like, I hope I don't miscite the study. It's like, people who work and are complaining about the work are still overall happier and more satisfied than people who are spending all their time on leisure, because at least the people who are working and complaining about work still have a community.
Right. And I think I remember them saying in the book that, like, people are happier at a job, even one that they hate, than when they don't have a job at all, because generally people want to work, was one of the, like, takeaways from this book, I think.
Yeah, because it gives them purpose and community, right?
Yeah. And then I also recently read something that talked about how people think that if they have more time, that, you know, like, retirees and stuff are going to volunteer more, or they're going to do like social good things more. And turns out not to be the case. They watch TV.
Yep. Yep. I think he talks about that too in the book, right? Because he talks a lot about time and how we use time and how we perceive time. Oh, and
yeah.
That, like,
yeah, yeah, yeah. It's all coming back.
In general, people who value time and take advantage of time, like, over money, are, like, more satisfied. But time is perception. We don't actually get that much more time when we have leisure. It's like about like what we actually value. So I think he talks about that in the book too.
Okay. Yeah. Yeah.
But then, like, back to the bleeding, kind of the bleeding of things, the boundaries, like, this dude bro that you were telling me about who wanted to do the 11 PM stand-ups, like, that resonated with me really hard in the book when he's talking about, he's primarily talking about, like, wealthier men in the US, but that this trend has started to bleed into all areas. That, like, the people who can afford not to spend all their time working are choosing to spend more of their time working because work has become their center of community. Right. Because work has become their identity. And so, like, the office is actually their leisure.
Yeah.
So it kind of feels like, in a way, like, that's what this dude was doing. Because it's like, if it's 11 p.m. and, like, he doesn't have anything of himself to do, like, this is actually his way to connect with other people. It's not even just a loyalty test. It's, like, also, like, this is, like, genuinely how you're getting your connection at this point.
Yeah, because they also talk about how, like, oh, because these, like, super powerful wealthy dudes are, like, they've decided that they want to work more, not because they need to, because they, like, just feel like it for these reasons, is, like, why we all also have, like, all this work to do that, like, we in normal circumstances, like, wouldn't need to do or wouldn't have to do, is kind of, like, satisfy their need for that, like, social, you know, so which is funny, because there's all those jokes about, like, oh yeah, AI is never going to replace us, because ultimately the people in power want, like, a bunch of people to manage. So, like, you're like, safe, right? Like,
yeah, it's like part of the power and ego of like, of owning capital, I guess.
Exactly. It's like the pendulum will swing back to this. It's like, first they want to, like, prove to the investors, whatever, that they can have small teams and, like, just these outsized numbers for whatever, you know, AR per employee or whatever. And then once, like, everyone's cool with that, it'll, like, swing back to, okay, like, the bigger the employee base that you have or whatever, like, the more power you have, whatever it is. So, yeah,
that's probably also one of the reasons why, like, it's generally smaller teams, startups, people who actually, like, know each other as people don't have those same power dynamics, not just because we're talking about small organizations versus large organizations, but because that sense of community in a, like, and purpose.
Yeah.
In a smaller company like that is organic. You don't have to force it or fabricate it.
Yeah. I mean, in theory, yes. Although I think, like, I've seen that culture in the largest organization that I've ever worked in and not seen it in a smaller organization that I've worked in. So I think, like, maybe it's an outlier situation, but I think it just all.
No. But say more. Like, I think, like, that's interesting to me.
Yeah, I think so. You know, again, names are being changed to protect the guilty or whatever, but, like, you know, I think some of the larger organizations that I've worked in have had some etiquette in place around what we do with our employees after hours. Like, they were explicitly, the unspoken rules were spoken out in onboarding for the team, right? Not necessarily for the company, but for those teams in particular, which, like, when I've worked in roles that required you to be a little bit on on call, you know, at unusual hours. That was explicitly stated. And it was also explicitly stated that if you do these things, you know, off hours or off peak hours, whatever, then you make up for it, and not like it goes in some bank and you make up for it down the line. But they would explicitly say the general recommendation we have is make up for it within 2 weeks. Right. So they're sort of creating a space for you to be able to do that. Whereas in some of the smaller organizations, because there's such a sense of community, there is an erosion of boundaries as well, where it's like, well, we're all in this together, we're a family, so like,
yeah,
who should this?
No, we're I think we're agreeing. Like, I agree. Like, in smaller organizations, it's more difficult to draw those boundaries, because like community and identity and purpose are so interwoven into like that small group of people. But like the counterbalance, and I think this is sort of where I was going a moment ago, is that because it's interwoven, and generally because the people who are going to opt into that sort of culture, they're really like opting in, it doesn't feel as forced when it happens.
Yeah. Well, and I think too, probably there is something to do with there's, you know, small organizations probably signal having potentially founders still in the mix. And so the culture really flows from the founder. And that's like something that's like incredibly important to them, to be like, the culture is what I want it to be. Whereas in these large organizations, you have less of a monoculture, and like there's these little, you know, these sort of separate cultures that come together. The other thing I was thinking about is, in larger organizations, you're probably more likely to have a wider range of ages. And so you're going to have people in different life stages as well. Right. And so one thing I will say too, is like, when I was much younger and really trying to like make my way in tech, I was much likely to stay later or like go out with my coworkers after work and that sort of thing. You're younger, you don't have kids, you don't have a lot of responsibilities, you know, like
the office is like your formative place where you're like forming these relationships. Exactly, like when you're younger, you just went from like making friends at college, or like, you know, going out to bars or something, like just right. post-college, to like, oh, like, where do I make friends now? Oh, I guess it's the office.
Right. Well, and it's like, there's some people that I have managed to have been like, I've moved to this city to work here, so I have no friend group. So the office becomes their friend group. That wasn't the case for me, right? Like, I graduated here, so I still had friends here. And then I was going to the workspace, but I had the energy levels there and the like social calendar, where I was like, okay, like, I am hanging out with my work friends on Monday, Tuesday, and then I can still go out on Wednesdays and hang out with my like college friends, or my, you know, like whatever. So your entire calendar is completely open to live your whole life. Whereas when you get older, no one's going out, you know, in their late 30s.
Oh yeah, like one dinner at the wrong time and I'm knocked out. Come on. Yeah. Like.
So I'm like, okay. And I remember I had this friend who had just had, or this coworker, we were building a team. He had just had a baby. His wife had just had a baby. And we were all going to happy hour after work. And he was like, I can't go. I got to like go. And, you know, everyone's giving him a hard time, like lovingly. Like, oh, you got to come out. Don't be such an old fart. You're only like 35 or something. And you just had a kid. Like, what are you doing? You could still go to happy hour. And now I think about it and I'm like, I don't have a kid. And there's no way I could do a happy hour. I just can't do it. So I think.
Yeah, no. Like, does it. It's like kids certainly, like, I think add a level of complexity that we cannot even fully appreciate or speak to. But I agree. There's just like something at a certain point where like you have less energy to expend, and you're craving your energy from different sources.
Yep. Yeah. Okay. So I think some of the points in there that we've made too, is that like, I think that people are really impacted if they're early career or if they've moved for a job by not having a third place in a new city, like, you know, or that community in a new city can actually be quite acute if work becomes a part of your identity in a different way.
Yeah. And this really goes into, cause like in the second part of the book, he's, you know, I think we should at least say a word on this, cause this is also, we talk about a lot, the idea of remote work, and that being, you know, the, like, of course it was around pre-pandemic, but you know, everyone all of a sudden was forced into it. But, he has a concept in the book that it was like the first time I ever felt like I heard a really convincing, well-formulated argument about the real benefits of office work. Because like my point of view on this before had been like I was generally pro-remote.
Mm-hmm.
Like, you know, you and I both worked for companies that were really like enabling people to do a lot of remote work, blowing up during the pandemic, Slack and Miro respectively. And so like my point of view on this was always like, well, you know, it doesn't matter, right? Like teams can make team level agreements and figure out how they want to do their work and it's fine. But he actually made like one of the first arguments that really resonated with me about like why that actually might not be true. Because he kind of talks about this idea. Do you remember he talks about like hard work and soft work?
Uh-huh, a little bit, yeah.
And basically these being terms that he made up. Mm. But, you know, the hard work is the stuff that you actually come in to do, the stuff that's in your job description, the widgets you produce, the lines of code you write, like all of that, right? But then there's the soft work, which is the socializing and the making connections and finding allies and building rapport, complaining about things, right? Like the paradox of work stuff. And what he was pointing out is that like for teams who are already working well together and for people who did a lot of the hard work and really needed to focus, like working at home was really good. But equally, when they looked at the effects of remote work and especially people who are doing full-time remote and not like intentional hybrid, remote actually was worse for new teams who were forming and didn't already have those like deep mutual senses of intention. You talked about stage of life and stage of career, like young employees who were new in their career, like didn't see anyone to model off of. Teams had fewer breakthroughs together, right? When they weren't working together in person. And also outgroups weren't getting incorporated as much. It was like teams who already felt comfortable working together continued working together remotely, but they weren't really like intentionally making room for new people to break in. And he also talked about like how, you know, remote, like we all know this, it's just harder to read tone and intent. So that really resonated with, because like even though at Slack, for instance, we did a ton of work to try to make text and asynchronous collaboration more human with emojis and etiquette and bots and all sorts of norms like this, like this really resonates with me. I felt like when we all started working in a distributed manner, like I had to deal with a lot more of this, like people not seeing eye to eye or misreading each other's tones or preferring to work with the people that they already felt really comfortable with and having like a lot of conflict with people who they didn't know as well. And I was like, oh, wait, I think that is true. Like, what do you think about that? How does that strike you?
Yeah. So yes. And I also have some counterpoints to it that I noticed over time too. So one of the things that I'll say is like, I 100% agree that like onboarding and young employee, those use cases, like they suffer a ton. I think there should be some component of in-person onboarding for everyone, even if it's just a week or something. I think that makes a huge difference. And then I think that the young employee thing is a big challenge, right? The osmosis and the, you know, like kind of adopting similar behaviors as people that are more experienced than you. You know, I think that those are things that when you're newer in the workforce, you would be at a disadvantage if you didn't get to observe. Like observation is as important as like, you know, shadowing. It's different from shadowing, but it's like observation, shadowing, assisting, like that's kind of how you like level up it, like at work, right? When you're first, like those
you sort of see things like serendipitously as well, not just even having like desk sides with your
exactly your right. Like, and you know, and I think some of those things, maybe you could argue like, look, everything is available on Gong, go listen to calls and that kind of a thing, but it's still a little bit different. Like you're not going to get all of the way there, but it's good enough now. But I still think like to optimize, that's what I would do. In terms of ideas, I question that a little bit. It worked at Miro, but I think there's so many tools now that like do help groups come together and like produce great value. But I think there is a benefit to getting together to do brainstorming and you know, having an offsite and all of that is really great. But again, I think that it doesn't need to be super frequent, and I don't think it needs to be every week. And I think that you will have diminishing returns when you extend that time frame, right? So that's
I completely agree with that. And I would love to see, like, I think there is research that shows that as well that probably like contradicts the research, because I think like the research he talks about in there is about like breakthroughs in science, where it's like teams of researchers who are co-located are like more likely to have a breakthrough. I completely agree. Like if you have a hybrid, because like regardless of whether you're in the office or remote, like most teams at this point, at least the types that we work with, are distributed. And you're not going to have someone in the same office anyway. So like, how do you foster innovation? Yeah. Like it's not like, yeah, you do want to have some of the, like, I'm coming in on random days of the week to just like run a random idea by a coworker, make a new connection that I haven't, like that is part of like the soft work as well.
Yeah.
But like for the intentional stuff, like really coming together, building that mutual sense of intention, brainstorming, coming up with breakthrough ideas, like,
right.
I completely agree with you. Like having like intentional offsites and things like that, where people actually come together is a better place for that to happen.
And have a great agenda. Like, it's like, I remember when we would do, you know, when I was in consulting and you would do an on-site with a customer. I mean, the amount of time you spent crafting that agenda and making sure that you could facilitate those outcomes I don't see that now as much, or haven't seen it since I've been consulting in various companies I've been at. So then that kind of like makes that in-person time not as valuable too. So it's like, by virtue of being together, it's like, doesn't just mean you're going to get the outcomes you're looking for. Like, you really have to design it well.
No, you have to set it up. Totally.
And I also think that, you need to create unstructured time for people to go build those relationships, because the other bad thing that can happen is you bring everybody together at an offsite somewhere, and then they're overscheduled within an inch of their lives and they could never get together. And like, the best thing is sometimes you've got those relationships or you're forming those relationships and it's like, you kind of want to cut class and you want to go and talk and really like dig into something together. And if you don't create time for people to do that, it's not really a good use of time. So, okay.
Yeah. I feel like I'm often saying this, right? Because like, our time together is precious and onsites are expensive. I know, but like, I agree. Like if we schedule them within an inch of our lives, we don't have time for serendipitous connections. Like, first of all, side quests are going to happen anyway.
Yes.
But they're going to happen in the cracks between
the
already overscheduled time. So it's like, it doesn't feel like quality time.
Yes.
At that point. And if you've been thinking and engaging and on all day.
Yeah.
Like you're just tired at a certain point.
That's exactly it. Right. And so it's like, then you're sacrificing your sleep to have those side quests and stuff. So like, no, you should actually bake that into the time that people are together. So, okay, so there's that piece. What I will say, though, that I think is, maybe this has been covered in somewhere, but a lot of, I think, what Derek Thompson talked about was like, oh, you can't really like see people and stuff like that. But he was referring to Slack, where a lot of misunderstandings can happen in tone and stuff like that. So I do think a lot of the problems he talked about are also solved by turning your video on. Which I know sounds like not breaking, but I actually, like, in the pandemic went from a company where we did not have our video on ever to a company where you were always expected to have it on. And there is a difference. So I think that was like a little bit overwrought in the book. But here's the other thing. Why are we so hell bent on avoiding conflict at work? That's the thing that I don't understand. It's like, look, if the tones are off or if people disagree or whatever, actually leaning into those, like, I'm a big proponent, you know, of the whole like Pixar way of doing things, but leaning into the brain trust, creating a brain trust, like those things only happen when you disagree and you know how to like come out of that disagreement in a good way. And I've worked for years at companies where they do everything to mediate away from the problem or the conflict instead of like leaning into it. And that can be bad too. So sometimes I think like the hybrid sort of way where like you do have these issues that come up in something like Slack, but then you actually try to solve them in person together and actually get to a point of really discussing and becoming like a true team that can have arguments and come out the other side better and like more aligned. I think that's a good thing. And we don't really like, we're afraid of doing that in the workplace. And sometimes I think because of this, like, well, you either love remote or you love, you know, like in person, I think you lose that part of the conversation, which is that for a team to be really strong, the conflict is not always a bad thing. In fact, I would argue that if in 2 years your team hasn't had a fight, like not a bad fight, right? But like a good fight, you're doing
something. Yeah, then you probably aren't making much progress. Yeah, no, I agree. And I love that you called that out because when he talks about kind of misunderstandings and things like that, he is talking about text. He's not talking about like being in different locations. If I can see your face, if I can read your tone, if I can ask you questions about what you're saying, then we can work through those things just as if we were in the office together. I think the examples that he gives in the book, when he's talking about that, he's definitely talking about like the example he gives is like, if I pitched my boss an idea and my boss said to me, okay,
yeah,
that would be fine, right? Like, I would have no objection to that. If I pitch my boss that same idea over text and they send me a one-line email response that says, okay, I might, like, a million thoughts are going to go through my head, right? Which is like, oh, do they hate me? Do they hate the idea? Like, right. Whatever, right? Like, it really does reinforce that negative. So, like, I agree, like, with you both that it's not necessarily about teams actually being in the same location all the time. It's about having a way to build that mutual sense of intention to be able to bring more like tone and emotion into even asynchronous work, which is why like I'm a big proponent of in Slack, like using things like, you know, emojis in your text and things like that. But also, yeah, to your point, just like freaking asking questions and picking up the phone when something is ambiguous and not spending too much time like reading into things. And I'm going to actually have to correct myself now because I opened the book and I'm looking at what he was talking about with the study of the remote scientists and what he's saying. I'm just going to read it. He says, groups working without face-to-face interaction have historically been less innovative, according to a new paper on remote work and science. For decades, teams split among several countries were five times less likely to produce breakthrough science that replaced the corpus of research that came before it. But in the past decade, the innovation gap between on-site and remote teams suddenly reversed. Today, the teams divided by the greatest distance are producing the most significant and innovative work. And he asked the writers of the paper to explain that. And he said, like, the explosion of remote work tools such as Zoom and Slack was essential, but the most important factor is that remote scientists figured out how to be better hybrid workers. So I think that really supports.
That's great.
It supports what you're saying. And like, I feel it too. Like, I see the benefits of being in the office to have the serendipitous interactions and the soft work.
Yep.
I see the benefits of intentionally coming together to really like get those things out in the open, like kind of take those longer strides together because that kind of like fills your tank for everything that's going to come later.
Yep.
And still being able to have the flexibility to work in different locations, to be able to work at home, to do your focus work, et cetera. Like I'm very pro hybrid for that reason.
Yeah. Same. And I think too, like, I'm a big proponent of seasonality as well, right? There are seasons where you need to, like, I will put up in Slack or wherever, like a D&D situation, it's end of quarter. Like, do not speak to me. I'm a feral beast. Like this last 2 weeks of the quarter, like we're trying to hit certain goals. So I'm not going to be available. I'm not going to look too kindly on like last minute, you know, double bookings on my calendar. Like things have been calendar blocked for the last 2 weeks of the quarter. But when
we're not going to do the coffee chat right now, like that can be later.
No brain pickings. Like I have no brain. Okay. Like we're done. And
last you can't pick a brain that ain't there.
No, exactly. It's like last 2 weeks of a quarter. Like I do not exist. Right. Unless you're on my team or like one of my coworkers, partners, whatever, that we're working on something together. But then you get into like fiscal year planning. And you've got to be, you're probably going to be in person a lot more, right? There's going to be a bit of a crazy schedule. It's like you might be traveling for a week for this on-site, then you might do like at your location, like something that's a week where you're just with people all the time. And that is a lack of balance in both those ways, but they're necessary for that season. And I think that they're a part of the mix, right? Like so you balance sometimes means imbalance in different times. And then you kind of like revert back to the mean, and that's okay as well. So I think that like, you know,
even you're like,
the goal isn't, I think, to have some weird definition of balance that like goes from Monday to Friday to whatever. It's like, it needs to make sense for what you're trying to accomplish. And And then I think the rest of it needs to be that you have your like non-negotiables that, you know, that you need to come up with in terms of what you talked about with like coming up with a policy for using technology so that it doesn't use you, right? I think Cal Newport would say like have a shutdown routine at 6 p.m. every day. Like maybe that involves taking Slack off your phone if that's the kind of job that you have. You probably can't do that if you're an executive. Maybe your time is 8 or 9 or something, or you're like, I'm not available between 7 and 9 because I'm bathing the kids and putting them to bed or something, but then I might come back on and answer some emails or something, right? Like it just depends.
You have to find your own balance between like work and rest to kind of what you talked about earlier.
Exactly. And the other thing that I'll say too, that I have found in life is I used to think that that work and rest thing was so literal. It's like when you're working, you're just like constant. I mean, like whoosh myself, right? And then when I'm resting, it's like I'm rotting in bed, like like dark vampire mode. And I'm, you know, like ordering takeout and watching, binging something. I have found those to be the most exhausting ways of achieving work-life balance. For me personally, it's that middle thing that works better. Like when I'm working, it's like, yes, there are going to be periods of like intensity, but you want to do the natural pace thing that Cal Newport talks about now. I'm not going to use the term. He says slow productivity, but I know the word slow makes people just itch. So that's not what he's talking about. He's talking about natural pace, working at a natural pace. You know, so that's what you want to do. And then when you're resting, it's like, get your workout in, right? Like get your chores done, like do all of those things that actually support balance in life. But we don't, like, I didn't used to think of it that way. I thought it was like, go all out and then like,
rot. I work hard, I play hard. Like,
right. And it's like, no.
And then I rest hard.
Yeah.
Yeah, no, I agree. Yeah. I'm moving more towards what you're talking about as well. And the other way that I try to live this is like, I really believe in, like, there are kind of two things that you'll hear me talk about a lot. Like, one is like, I talk about healthy intensity.
Mm-hmm.
So that doesn't mean that we need to be like going ham all the time.
Yeah.
It means that we need to be working with purpose and clarity and trying to eliminate the things that take away from that, but also doing it in a way that feels healthy and productive, and where like ultimately, like, yeah, of course we're going to do some amount of things that just suck and we have to do them, but what can we do to optimize towards like the work that we do being the work that like does bring meaning and purpose? Because at least for me, work is a major source of purpose for me. Like, I don't want it to be my entire social circle anymore. I don't want it to be my religion, but I do want it to feel meaningful and rewarding.
Yeah.
But I don't want it to feel like everything. So the other thing that I always try to bring with me into my work is the idea of making work light.
Yeah.
And that also helps bring, I think, a sense, not of rest necessarily into work, but at least of like putting the intensity in context. So I try to like embrace lightness so that doesn't, like, everything doesn't feel like life or death, even when customers are complaining and the product is breaking and like all the crises that could go on. Like, you can't zoom in too much into that. You have to like remember that like we're solving this together.
Yeah. And I think that I think bringing fun into work is very underrated, but that is what actually like builds a lot of those relationships, like in strong teams, right? We all want to have fun. Like, we're all here to enjoy the journey. And I think we forget that, like, everything at work is so structured according to goals that like the like ultimate outcome or achievement is the thing that we talk about all the time, right? Annual reviews, you know, team meetings, like all of those like things that we punctuate our sort of work rhythms with are about that. They're not really about the journey. So I think like as a leader, it's important to me to think about how do I focus on this journey for my team, and how do I like make it something? Like, how do we make it something collectively that we own and we all feel responsible for on the team? And then I think to the point of making things light, I think another thing that I've always talked to my teams about that I think helps with this like work stuff is emotional regulation. So when there is an issue with a customer, it's like, look, you've got to help that customer solve that thing. But in the process, you need to emotionally regulate so that you don't destroy yourself, right? Because these things happen. And like mentally, you've really got to learn how to, you know, like not panic, not beat yourself up or whatever it is, but like there's a healthy way to take responsibility, accountability, and help, find a way out of the solution. But that only comes with, if you've got that like base, that grounding kind of like emotional regulation and kind of the toolkit for that, and that you practice it on a regular basis. This also helps, I think, like lean into those moments of conflict with that are going to happen. Like, and that's one thing about balance I always like to tell people is like, conflict is going to happen. It's absolutely guaranteed. You just have to figure
out. It's often healthy.
It is. You have to figure out what your relationship with it is going to be. It's not automatically a bad thing. In fact, it's actually where like the best ideas come from. And also like, this is how you can help your customers if you know how to deal with conflict, because they're going to have conflict within their own organizations, like using your product or tool or whatever it is. And so the more comfortable you're with it, you are with it, like you're going to be able to help them navigate it.
Love that. Love surfacing more healthy conflict. You got to regulate, Warren G.
Yes, Warren G, exactly. And I think about your relationship with work and think about it as something that is like evolving, maybe every job, maybe every couple of months, maybe every year.
Yeah, like whether it's your trusted pal, yourself, there's someone on my team who, Beaker, if you're listening, shout out, like always talks about the concept of like, doing the check-in with yourself every year and basically asking yourself like, hey, would I take this job again? Knowing what I know about it, like, will I actively commit to another year of doing this every year? And wow. I kind of love that concept of holding things in perspective like that.
I'll say one final thing too, before because I know this has been a long conversation, but there is another, there's several people that have this idea of like creating a value statement every year for yourself, right? Like of like what you kind of want to get out of life and having that full balance there. Right. Like, so you might say, okay, like I want to excel at these things at work. I really want to, this isn't my statement, like learn how to grow things in my yard, like in my garden. Right. And so like you have this idea of what you want to accomplish for the year. And then, you know, really like use that as a way to guide yourself, understanding fully that you're going to have seasons where you will be off balance and that that's okay. And that like, if you do check in periodically and you feel like that season has gone on too long, like come back to it. But I think that we all want and should want to enjoy the journey, because like, I don't remember from my like previous jobs, all the destinations that I got to. I remember the things that I did with my teams. I wish that I had like realized that earlier, because I would have had so much more fun at work and not have gotten so caught up in a lot of this like identity stuff and lost myself. And like, when you do that, work becomes so much more fun. And guess what? You actually become better at it. It's wild.
It's true. Yeah. I love that, Dee. That is perfect. Cool. So yes, everyone read the book. It's On Work by Derek Thompson. Maybe we will say on the LinkedIn, if you read the book, what were your takeaways? What did you think was already funny or out of date, the way that he talks about AI in the book? Because this is still like the DALL-E era. Like, he's saying like therapists aren't gonna be affected by AI. Like, it's kind of funny. It's kind of cute, but like, shows how quickly everything has moved. Tell us your takeaways about this book. What do you think about work and your relationship to it?
I would love to hear how people, what your relationship with work is. So if you haven't read the book, feel free to focus on that question. If you've read the book, like Adam said, we'd love to hear your takeaways and how you manage this for yourself.
Amazing. And we are still a tiny, baby, baby, tiny podcast, and we would love your support. So, if this episode meant anything to you, please write about it on LinkedIn. Give our LinkedIn page a tag. Give us a tag. Tell us what this may have awoken in you. And if you're feeling extra kind, please give us a 5-star review on Apple Podcasts. You don't even need to write anything, though. If you do write anything, we will read it and we will appreciate it. We'll learn from it.
Thanks, everybody.
Thanks. See you next time.
Doodles. What was that thing you tried to make?
See you around the way. See you around the way. I said it once and then I got locked into it.
Oh my god. How is it the kids are doing the
Korean heart? It's like this.
No. You're like ahead of it. I'm even talking about the 2 years ago weird, you know, like how do they do the...
Oh, just the heart, like...
No, but this is fine. This is okay. They're doing something...
Oh, I don't know. I just know the Korean heart is like this.
I don't even know that. So that's the thing that I'm going to go Googs or AIs or whatever.
Because apparently, I don't know why it's Korean. I mean, I guess Korean people started doing it first and like they're trendy.
Okay.
But I guess it's like because it's supposed to look like the actual human heart. Boom, 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 boom.
Interesting. Boom, boom. Oh, the whole hand. I thought I was just looking at your fingers. Interesting.
I don't know. That's my guess. I'm also not hip, so I don't know.
I learn a lot of things from you about being hip. So, like, you introduced me to Chugi.
Oh, Chugi.
Yeah.
Yeah. I mean, what is that? I'm like online. I work with young people and I'm really scared of young people judging me. So I try to like keep up with what they talk about.
So it's like, I spend a lot of time online. I also work with young people and I don't know these things. My husband and my sister had to explain all of the like Kendrick Lamar, Drake stuff to me that I had missed years. Like and it's fascinating and amazing. Why did I not encounter it given the amount of time that I spent online? I don't know. I didn't know what Chugi was. I didn't know about no cap and skipping the toilet and any of those things until they were like really like, anyway, it's fine. Yeah.
Well, we just talked about like, if the other two things are the constants, then like if we're both fairly online and we both work with young people, then the variable clearly is that I'm just way more scared that like young people are going to judge me. So I make more of the effort to keep up.
You have over, yeah, maybe I've already been judged in a past, like, because I did used to work with high school girls in an after school program for a really long time back when, like, Edward and Jacob were the, like, hot topic of choice. That's a Twilight reference.
Yeah, I was about to say, like, are those your friends?
I was like, well, it's just like I was pretty thoroughly roasted when I, in this job, like, my friend Z and I did this job when I was 27 or something. So I was already considered old by the youth at that point. So I've never felt the need to impress them because the first time I tried, I failed. So then I was like, all right, let's not optimize for that at all ever again. So that's probably what it is. I think you might be right.
It's entirely possible. Yeah, I didn't have that moment where I got like shamed out of existence. The closest I came to that was when I was about the same age and we had like a junior recruiter or like recruiting a talent coordinator start at work. And I was like saying something about Enron and then it like hit me for a moment that she's young. So I was like, hold on. Do you know Enron? Awesome. And she made such a face and she was like, I know of it. Oh, and I can't, that moment is frozen in my mind forever. Like I know of it is, yeah, I felt so ancient. It was amazing.
I know of it.